For the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we're going to chat with author, historian, host, podcaster, multi-talented man, Gareth Russell. He is the host of a very good podcast about history, and he has several books out, including a very fun book called Do Let's Have Another Drink. It's about the Queen Mother. He's a very charming man, and we had a really great time. Here's Gareth. Hi, Gareth. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sherry. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to chat with you. I'm a fan of your podcast.
Thank you. That's very kind. Really, kind of really appreciate that.
I do. I really enjoy it. I always learn something when I listen to your shows. I love history. I have since I was a little tiny girl, and so
yeah,
it's fun to listen to it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really do appreciate that. It's it was something that grew a little organically, or maybe accidentally is the better word, out of lockdown. I did a few sort of YouTube videos, I think one on sort of disparate topics, like one on the life of Anne Boleyn, one on Tsar Nicholas II have a nervous breakdown in 1915 and 1916, you know, a little bit about William the Conqueror, you know, different things. And I really enjoyed it, and the feedback seemed pretty positive. So I'd done quite a few interviews for podcasts, and that's when I thought, well, actually, maybe doing something of my own and then being able to focus on different topics from week to week would be a nice idea. And that's how my podcasting called Malt History began. So it was, yeah, I really appreciate that, because it was 2020 it started, but it did feel at the time like, it was 2021 the podcast started. It did feel a little bit like sailing out into the unknown. So I'm very touched to hear that you enjoy it. Thank you.
Oh, I do. It's like I was having a discussion with one of my friends, and one of the things that I find interesting is how emotional people get over history. Mm-hmm. Like, she was talking about she was at a lecture for Anne Boleyn. And
yeah,
she said that the lecturer was talking about Anne Boleyn, but he really didn't like Anne Boleyn, and that she felt like she was, like, there under false circumstances or something, and she got really mad at him, but
right. She
stayed for the whole lecture, but she, and it's like,
sure,
long dead queen, you know.
Right. Right. I mean, look, I was on an event recently where, I have to be careful how I say this because I don't want to make it obvious where I was, but I was there in a kind of quasi-official capacity, and in any case, when I'm on like a guided tour, I never correct the tour guide. I don't like doing it. I think it, first of all, I could be wrong, and secondly, I think even if they are, you know, maybe there's something that I think a lot of people realize is wrong, I think what's far more important than correcting someone is respecting someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if it's not going to do anyone any harm, why on earth would you disrespect this person in their place of work? I don't like that at all. But he made quite a few comments, actually, strangely, about Anne Boleyn that I thought were in quite poor taste. And I thought that, and some of the things were certifiably incorrect. But Whereas I think when I was younger, I would have really fidgeted. I think what it's such an interesting point you raised there, Sherry, because I've been mulling on this recently quite a lot when I see just how emotional people get about it. And so if I was to compare what your friend did, which is absolutely, I would argue, the correct thing, which is you can be a bit frustrated at what's said, but you still have the courtesy as well as the intellectual solidity to sit and listen to someone that you don't agree with and be respectful. That I think is, and also it's really important to listen to people you don't agree with. It's like, the gym for your mind. It's this is more religious, but St. Thomas Aquinas said that, muscles, sorry, wit is to muscles what doubt is to faith. You become better by listening to things you don't agree with. But what your friend did absolutely is the correct thing. You can, I'm not saying every time I hear something that I really don't like, but I'm like filled with a sort of kumbaya spirit. Sometimes I think, ugh. But I still try to sit and listen. I think that's the most important thing. And the contrast to that is, actually, funnily, it happened today, just before, maybe an hour before you and I were able to meet, where I saw someone post about, I mean, really a figure in British history that I would say does not, I don't think of as provoking intense passions, but they got into a full argument on one of my accounts with another user. I think it was King George V.
You're
And it
kidding.
was, yeah, I was like, this was not my bingo card for today, or indeed for this year. But, because your reaction says everything. George V, king from 1910 to 1936, is generally, with the exception of when people talk about the Romanov asylum bid, it's not one that people get particularly emotional about. But anyway, the level, like the speed with which this just like accelerated into name calling and insults, and I just thought was baffling. And one of the things that I am so conscious of is the cruelty that we are capable of through keyboards. And I recently, yeah, it's really something. And again, I don't want to say who, but a few weeks ago, I had dinner in London with a novelist, and they were telling me about a historical novelist, I should say, and they were telling me about some of the Facebook groups that had been set up against them and some of the things that had been written and said against them.
Oh my gosh.
And they're a very impressive person. They're very confident and very successful. But they were saying, about some of the things that have been sent to them. Because they wrote about neither of the periods that we've discussed, but they talked about, just some of the things that have been said and done to them. And I thought, God, that's actually quite sobering to realize that even very strong people can be wounded by this. And I think, to boil it all down to your point about passion, I think we have to stop falling out with people and hating people because we disagree over what happened in 1536 or 1480. Or 1483. I've had people lose it with me over dinners when I said I think Richard III killed Edward V. And had I said that I enjoy drowning kittens, they could not possibly have been more aghast that I had said it. And they almost went purple, like they were screaming at me. And I said, just going to stop you there. I have no idea who you think you're talking to, but it's definitely not going to be me. I'm not spoken to like that by anyone unless I have accidentally set fire to their home. And I have no interest in disliking you or you disliking me because we disagree about something that happened 6 centuries ago and for which there is no definitive proof that I am right or you are right. And even if there was, even if I had said something insane, like I think Margaret Beaufort flew on her broom into the Tower of London, kidnapped the children and took them to live in Svalbard, you know, something truly insane, you still don't need to react that way. And I think the thing to take from history is it has already, when it happened, caused so much anguish and despair and division between people that the last thing it should do is still inflicting divisions between us in its death. You know, let's enjoy from history. Let's feel very passionately about history. I certainly do. I love history. And sometimes what happens, the sheer injustice of it all, is enraging or devastating. But above all, let's take it to improve the present and improve the future rather than divide us or lead us to be sort of casually cruel because we disagree about something that happened in the 1700s.
Yeah. I kind of relate to that because I belong to a mystery group, and we were reading Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay.
Yes, it's a very good book.
It is. It's like a page-turner. It's like it's a mystery, even though it's not. It's like it's just a guy who's stuck in the hospital looking at stuff up because he thinks Richard III isn't a killer. I mean, it was really, was fun.
Yeah, it's a great book.
But
it's a great, great book.
Boy, there was more.
Sorry, Carrie Graham.
I was just gonna say there was more fights in the group over this book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just don't think that grown adults should be flinging insults at each other over a 15th century monarchy ruled for 2 years, or 20 years, or 40 years, or I don't think anything from the 15th century should be causing us to insult someone in the 21st. I don't agree with that. And my postgraduate studies were in medieval history. I think when you get into the area, obviously, of saying, I don't know, obviously when it's, if you're someone who's trying to downplay mass suffering, like say the diaspora, the expulsion of the Jewish community from England in 1290, and saying, oh, it wasn't that bad, then there's a different kind of red flag there. Then you're talking about something
that still hurts.
Very different.
Yeah, that still hurts.
That still hurts. And also that is an aperture into, I think, probably a bigger set of problems with your political beliefs. If you're trying to say the diaspora or something wasn't that severe. There is the ghosts of that event in 1290. They are those revenants. They are still with us culturally and morally. But whilst I am not in any way downplaying the tragedy of the disappearance of Edward V and his brother, Prince Richard, I personally, I'm never going to equate that with something on the scale of the diaspora. And so I'm not saying nothing from the Middle Ages should still invoke and incite passion and concern and passionate interest, absolutely. And I love listening to someone who thinks Richard III is innocent, because if they are respectful towards those who don't. And I'm taking the Richard III example because we're talking about Josephine Tay here. Any of those historical big questions are worthwhile. I think often, unfortunately, it's really just a cudgel to metaphorically beat someone that you don't agree with. And that's where I think we're actually really doing history and all its complexities and the comfort it gives us. And what I mean by the comfort it gives us, Sherry, is I think of all the times in my life when a good history book has taken me away from somewhere and it's brought me to another place and another time, and sometimes it's a horrifying time, but it's lifted you out of a time, I think, that's in your life that you should be grateful for the work of historians and the splendors and savagery and extraordinary stories of the past. But I think we're doing all of it a disservice when we are using it to humiliate and belittle people. And I certainly know when I was younger and in my early 20s and the rise of the internet was happening, I wasn't always very respectful in kind of the group chats and things like that. I was a bit of a prig. And I think you learn the lesson of there is not one single day in your life nor one single point that is made better or stronger by belittling another person over anything, and in this case particularly or pertinently over history.
I just think it's sad that people have the need to hurt superiority over another because
yes.
they
yeah.
may know a few more facts than the other person. It's like so cruel and stupid.
It is. It's both of those things, and it is also, to merge them, it is stupidly cruel and cruelly stupid. Because I think I can tell you, sometimes you can spot those comments. People will comment under a post that I've written or a friend's written, and they'll give to another commenter a very confident, slightly patronizing list of facts that they've missed, or they haven't understood. And often the fact that they're very confidently giving are themselves questionable or debated. And, you know, there may be some historical research that's coming out that that I know or have, you know, that if you're a historian, your job is to keep on top of these things. And the it's not that facts are always changing, it's that there's often I think it's extraordinary, really, to look at. Yeah, I sort of lost my train of thought slightly with that one, but that's sort of. I think you're right. It leads into the facts aren't always. I'm trying to think of the best way to put this, Sherry, without necessarily the facts aren't always changing. This idea that there's no such thing as empirical truth, that is not true. There are facts, but they're often being. There's been more meat being put in the bone. Not a perfect metaphor, but better than a dead sentence.
Okay, I got it.
I think sometimes when people come out with these comments, you're like, oh, that's not really what all historians think. A very small example. Someone referred recently in a post to Anne of Cleves,
mm-hmm.
Henry VIII's fourth wife, and someone said, actually, it's Anna. She signed her name as Anna, and I wanted to write and be like, actually, there are legal documents from later in her life where Anne is used. And also, it's generally done in the history of monarchy by the princesses as the starting point that their name is translated from their native name into the name of the country they're marrying into, because part of royal marriages is the princess ceases to be of France, of wherever she comes from. She becomes the first lady of the new country. That's why you have never heard of a queen. You know, you've never written about Queen Maria Antonia von Österreich, of Queen of France. You've written about Marie Antoinette,
mm-hmm.
or Henrietta Maria, rather than Henriette Marie, Queen of England. So within, some people do use the original names, but generally speaking, some people, for instance, if you're looking at Marie Antoinette or Catherine of Aragon, some historians use the name that they, before their marriage, they're Catalina or Maria Antonia, and after the marriage, it's Catherine and Marie Antoinette, if for no other reason than it can be very confusing to readers, and also that is what the queens themselves did. But anyway, the point of it is, this person was very confident that they were schooling everyone for being stupid in using Anne rather than Anna. And some historians do use Anna. The first one to use Anna in her book was Antonia Fraser, when she wrote a book called The Six Wives of Henry VIII in 1992, I think. And Heather Darcy, who's written a biography of Anne, uses Anna. And there are reasons for that. Heather's work is primarily focused on the Clevian or German aspects of Anna. And Antonia Fraser, in a move I have, Shannon, I can completely empathize with, and I'm sure many Tudor fans can agree with too. She said, I three Catherines, two Annes, and a Jane, wherever I can find a way to differentiate between them, I will do it. So, and I have absolutely no problem with that incredibly welcome pragmatism. And so she picked Anne for Anne Boleyn and Anna for Anne of Cleves. But I mean, the thing is, it can be things that small that people can correct over. Likewise, it can be bigger things. So I think always remember that, you know, a tiny, always remember too that not everyone who is commenting online is in the same place intellectually and more importantly, emotionally. So, you know, this could be someone who's just maybe starting out on their journey of interest into history. It could be someone who has genuine questions and is trying to incite a conversation to educate themselves. It could be someone who's quite interested in the historical period you're interested in, but isn't as interested in it as you are, and that's okay. Not everyone has to care about the same issue as much as everyone else. But the other thing I think that's so important is sometimes you might be keyboard kicking someone who's had a really bad day, week, month, or year, and are really just hanging on, you know, hanging together by a bit of emotional shoestring. And you being a bit of a bully, or a bit flippant, or even cruel. And by the way, we're all capable of being rude online. You know, I'm not the finishing school perfect coach in this. I certainly have been guilty of it. But I'm always trying to tell myself, no matter how irritated you get, remember, this person might be having a really, really bad day. And the last thing they need is someone they've never met making them feel like a fool or making them feel less than. Because we're all capable of inflicting that kind of embarrassment. I think it's really unfortunate when our better angels don't win out.
Yeah. I think the important thing is that history is so you can learn. History is so you can increase your knowledge and expand and learn about different countries and different time periods. And also, you were talking about reading history as a comfort. To me, it is. And it's like time travel. You pick up a book about Anne Boleyn and you're back in that period. It's a great thing. And stop making it like, I don't know. If I'm right and you're wrong and therefore you're an idiot. That kind of philosophy is beyond me.
Well, that's where we are, I think. It's not just in history. It's in so many ways. These things are just apertures into broader social trends.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
where we are.
Yeah.
With politics, religion, you know, and I've seen people who would say, like, I would love, you know, a conservative saying, I would love to sit down and have a debate with a really intelligent, you know, liberal who doesn't resort to name calling, and vice versa, progressives or leftists or liberals saying, I would love to sit down with a proper libertarian or conservative and have a conversation. I think you don't vote. You're saying that. You think, you truly believe that you do. But I've seen you when a really smart conservative or a really good faith liberal has come to have a conversation with you and you've lost your mind. And you've immediately gone to name calling. So I think that is where I think a lot of us despair of that trend politically. I think very few of us are actually prepared to do the work of listening to the other person. And I see that across the spectrum. Refusing to listen is very much a bipartisan issue. And I also think it happens not just in politics, it happens in history and literature and all these kind of things, where we simply seem to have become more intolerant. And I do think we were having a little bit of a discussion before we started recording. And just for listeners, I think we were discussing a little bit about maybe the chimera of technology and the fact that it's not actually bringing us closer. And I was so interested in an article I written, I think last year, perhaps the year before, by Monica Lewinsky, where she made a point that has stuck with me and I was thoroughly convinced by, which was, she feels that the internet has created the modern day equivalent of the stocks in the village town square, and that we like to put people in them for sins real or imaginary and pelt them with things and humiliate them. And in fact, I think, to kind of go to the point of history, in many ways we are taking one of the worst parts of the past, which I think was dimmed a little bit in the mid of the 20th century, but not by very much. Late mid. But which is the ritual humiliation of an individual by the collective, and the thrill and pleasure that people can take in throwing rotten food at someone who's brought to the village stocks to be shamed.
Isn't it
and
sad?
And that's still there.
Isn't it sad?
Of course it is.
Because
absolutely.
I was raised by a father who would talk to anyone, first of all. And
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
He was wonderful, and he was funny, and he was really, really smart. And he would sit down and talk to, he was very liberal. I remember I was in a play, and he drove me to the play, and we were early, which is not unusual for my family. And one of the people in the play was also early, and we were sitting out, and he's very conservative. My dad and he got into this conversation. It was friendly. They were having fun.
Yeah.
It was just a chat. It wasn't life or death. They just were just talking about, you know, politics and stuff, but they were talking about it as two intelligent people from two different points of view exchanging ideas. They laughed at the end, said, see you later, and Dad gave me a kiss and left, and that was it. There was no blood in the water,
yeah.
No argument, and that is how I was raised. So to me, this whole way that the world has come, turned, is beyond my understanding. I simply don't get it.
Well, what your father did and what the conservative gentleman you're referring to there did, from what I can tell, is they talked to each other,
mm-hmm.
and today we talk at each other. It's
yeah.
not the same thing.
Yeah.
So if you go on, so I think if you, I mean, there are very few, there's a couple of conservatives, a couple of liberals who I can think of who I would exempt from them. So it's not universal. But if I look at most left or right wing leaning media outlets, be that social media or more established traditional media, and if I look even at comment sections, etc., it is all preaching to the choir. It is never about sincerely trying to get, in your case, you know, in your case, a Democrat or a Republican. You're American, sorry, Sherry, aren't you? As well?
Yeah, I'm an American.
I'm not
looking.
Yeah,
Californian.
Oh, sorry. I was just about to say, I didn't know whether I'm always quite conscious because I made that mistake once before with a friend who I thought was American. Sorry, not a friend, a colleague, and they were Canadian.
Oh.
They've been living in America, but anyway, I always think it's always better just to ask a question rather than parade on incorrectly. But anyway, sorry, to your point, Democrat or Republican. I don't see them trying to convince a Democrat of the benefits of this Republican position. I certainly don't see vice versa.
Yeah, no.
And I think essentially what you're doing is you're just mocking this person. Even if you look at the way it's framed, you know, so-and-so owns, you know, or so-and-so destroys this conservative idiot, or so-and-so really shows up this liberal idiot. You know, it's all very combative. And the effect of that is the voting blocks will not turn. There will be many, many people who, you know, a conservative party could run a potato and they'd vote for it. Or a liberal party could run, I don't know, a can of Diet Coke and they'd vote for it. There's no longer any persuading people because the rhetoric of insulting people about what they think bunkers them down. It makes it personal. So it becomes a lot harder to vote based on a candidate, say.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, you know, some year, your priority is something that the Democrats handle better. 4 years later, 2 years later, whatever particular election cycle you're looking at, it's an issue that's become more important. And you think, oh, actually, the Republicans handle this one better. That used to be the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, you know, to be clear, a lot of what we've been saying is putting the culpability onto voters, and I do not diminish that. I'm someone who thinks, you know, take care of your mess, own your own mistakes, and I think we as voters have to, you know, take a large share of the blame for this. But in absolutely no way do I think any of the major political parties can be let off for the blame for pandering to this and for encouraging this and for solidifying this trait as how we discuss politics. And significant issues. And I have to say, and this is simply looking really at the UK, which has obviously, you know, the central parties in London, but it also has parties that are central to each of the four nations within the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of which mine is Northern Ireland. I'm thinking of the main London political parties. I'm thinking of my own, the political parties that stand for the local legislature here in Belfast. And I have to say, there are no great men or women. There are no great figures coming through them that I can see. There are no people, you know, and what I mean by that is not saints. The scrutiny we put politicians under is so ahistorical, because many of the great political leaders of the past had, to put it mildly, questionable private lives. You know, many of them had partied themselves senseless in the days before they, and you can't do that anymore. You're running for senator, not sin. And I don't see anyone of outsize personality who maybe has the intellectual heft, moral flexibility to get things done. I don't see anyone who really inspires me anymore, and I don't see anyone coming up the ranks who does either.
Somebody like Winston Churchill.
I think we're stuck in it. It's all gone. It's all those people are. We are an age of smaller people, and part of it is that we, to go back to your early point, we like it when politicians mess up, and we like it when. And what's interesting to me is, it's often the politician with the smaller sins who are the ones who are punished for it. Their careers are tanked. They are humiliated. We like it when they mess up, because so many of the decisions that they have made have messed up our lives or our country. So I understand that. But the problem with trying to hold them to a completely unobtainable standard is that eventually you are left with very morally and intellectually tiny people whose sole, if maybe not sole concern, but close to their sole concern, is getting you to like them. Not admire them, not respect them. It's getting you to just like them. Or, I think more commonly, to really, really, really dislike the opponent. And I think that's how you get the system that we're in. Because I can't think of any single politician who really, I think, both inspires and interests me. And maybe I just can't think of it at the minute, but that's where I kind of am, which is sad, really sad.
I know it's the same, well, you probably know it's the same here. There's really, it's very hard, because people are always looking for faults in everybody, even someone who's doing good.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's perfect.
Especially someone who's doing good.
Yeah, I mean,
especially someone who's doing good.
The thing is that I don't want people to start slinging arrows at me, but basically, Joe Biden in 2 years has done a lot of good stuff. He's not perfect. He's made mistakes. No president of the United States has ever been perfect, ever. Even George Washington. You know, or Abraham Lincoln, they were imperfect people just like they are today. The thing is, look at what the person is doing, not who the person is. That's the way I was taught when I was taught about politics, from
sure.
The same person, my dad and my mom. But the thing is, and this is my general rule. I really don't care about politicians' personal life. I don't care about what they're, you know, what's going on the side, as long as they are doing their job. And that's the problem right now. Most of them are not doing their job.
No, I think probably you're the same. If it's illegal, that's a completely different
kind of
fish.
Oh, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like, affairs and stuff like that.
No, exactly. And I think that's a really good point. I was conscious of the quote being taken out of context online, you know, that we just don't care at all. And I think you're absolutely right. The distinction you're drawing between the illegal and the immoral is interesting, because you specifically said adultery there, affairs, and that was kind of the point I was alluding to earlier, which is many of our great politicians and kings in the past and presidents were adulterous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I don't want to sound too much like a church committee member at Salem in the 1690s, but it doesn't necessarily, it does, I don't really, it's not going to make me, to put it mildly, I am not going to think any more of you as a person for having had one at all. And in my private life, I have, you know, it's, I'm not going to want to socialize with you, if I'm totally honest. In most cases, I think obviously the breakdown of any marriage is incredibly tragic. But what I mean is, I don't have to want to, this whole thing, I think it started the start of this century. He's the kind of politician you want to have a beer with, or he's the kind of politician you want to have at a barbecue. I have no interest in voting for you based on whether or not I like you, or I want you at a dinner party, or want to have a beer with you. I have friends for that. I want you to go to Westminster or Stormont or the Senate or Congress and do your job mm-hmm. and make my family's life easier, my country safer, our economy more stable. I have no interest in whether or not you are a person I want to sit down and like. That's not where I'm going with this.
Right.
And so I think, and if, you know, there are many politicians who have, male and female, who have had affairs, and it has made me think, ugh, that's horrible. And I've seen, you know, in friends, I have seen the heartbreak and devastation that adultery can frequently does
exactly
leave
yeah.
sort of the ashes of a marriage or a relationship, and just the sort of smouldering wreckage of hope and trust. It is a devastating thing. I do not diminish that in any way. But I also am very conscious of the fact that I do not want to live in a country where you're fired for a morality charge like committing adultery. And I think if we have that in place in business, we should have that in place in politics. So yeah, I agree with that.
I just think that is, you know, if you are elected, it shouldn't be your family that is the target of other people.
Yeah,
it should
yeah,
be
yeah.
you,
yeah, that's
the
fair.
Person who's elected, but not
yeah.
your family. It's like, and I'm trying not to get into what's going on here, but it should be, it's like you, when you're elected to office, you're elected to a job. It is a job.
Sure.
Your job is to, in the U.S., to uphold the Constitution, to do your job,
yeah.
to better the community, to make life better for the people who live here. It is not to throw mud at somebody who disagrees with you. I know that's what politics is now, but that's not what the job
right.
is.
Correct.
That's,
totally agree.
That's the way I feel. And I feel
yeah.
that it, we've lost that. It's like gone. It's like people don't seem to... I keep saying to my brother, I go, what the heck is going on with this country? I don't understand.
Yeah.
People care more about stupid stuff than they do about getting things done that helps everybody.
There are historical theories about that, some people call it end of empire behavior. There's not really a perfect name for it. Essentially, it is the theory that after a certain period, quote unquote, great nations, or large nations with a large amount of influence, there tends to be an internal crisis of faith about what the country means. And sometimes it can be happening at a period in which the country's global influence is going into decline. It can often, more often happen at a time when a country's economy is starting to slow down. And what happens is the big systemic problems, the shift in what the very nature of this country is, or what it means to its citizens, is so huge and such an enormous question to ask, and perhaps even a larger question to answer for the citizens, that unconsciously they begin to fixate on nonsense issues, often but not exclusively political scandals and gossip and smaller things, because they are unknowingly, or rather sort of unconsciously, focusing excessively and intensely on smaller issues because the larger issues are almost too big for them to face looking at. And I don't know whether that's too neat, and like many anthropological or sociological theories, there is a chance that that is simply too neat, and there will obviously be points to disagree with. But I do think that you can see that in a lot of countries at the minute, that there is a tendency to focus on what are, in the grand scheme of things, scandals and minutiae that will divide these citizens rather than unite them. It's also very interesting that at the same time as this happens, end of empire behavior, I don't really love that phrase because I think it has more of an ancient world connotation. I think it really arises from people looking at the stereotype of what was happening at the end of the Babylonian Empire in Rome. But anyway, it is also tends to be a period when we see an upswing in the number of people believing in conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
A particularly good period when this happened was immediately preceding the French Revolution, when all of this happened. And you saw economic downturn, and you saw a massive upswing in people focusing on really bizarre things like the affair of the necklace court case in 1785 and 1786. You saw people focusing on really absurd things. But you also saw a huge upsurge in the number of French citizens who believed in, I mean, insane conspiracy theories about what was happening, and that there were secret societies running everything. And this, by the way, is not something that is solely limited to the revolutionary movement. French royalists really, increasingly after the fall of the monarchy in 1792, a frightening number of them dug their nails in to cling on to these conspiracy theories to explain what had happened. That there were secret societies beneath the surface in French political life and cultural life that had worked together to plot to make the population overthrow the monarchy. That there had been schemes and lies and almost like unknown puppet masters pulling the strings that made this happen. Like for French royalists, they tended to believe that it was a Masonic Freemason conspiracy. And that they wanted to tear down the monarchy and also to tear down the Catholic Church. And they cited the French Revolutionary's policy of the enforced de-Christianization of France that did claim many lives as proof of that. But you are also beginning to see today an upsurge in the number of people who use the most potent and most misleading word in history, which is they. They want you to believe this. Mm. They are doing this. They say not. And I always want to say, and sometimes when I'm feeling quite puckish or pugilistic in an argument, I will say, who is they?
Mm-hmm.
Who is it?
My dad used to say that.
There is no they.
He used to say that quite often.
Yeah.
Who is they? Who are you
they.
Pointing to?
That's,
what are you talking about?
I'm sorry. And do you know what? There is no they.
Of
There's
course
never
not.
Been a they.
Uh-uh.
And this whole idea of vast conspiracy theories, etc., they might sound frightening. They aren't. What's even more frightening is that no one has any idea what they're doing, and that there is no grand plan, and that in many cases we are at the mercy of people with no grand plan. The idea that there are families controlling banking, I mean, first of all, laced with anti-Semitic tropes that the people who believe it either don't know about or I think don't care about. The idea that there are shadowy secret societies that control the world, I think lets us off the hook. All those conspiracy theories prevent us from asking the much more mundane, much more difficult, and in the end, much more provocative questions of what are the hundreds of incremental changes that we as voters and we as readers, to get back sort of, you know, we as thinkers should be doing to make society better, not only for the next generation, but for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was a big trend because of the Da Vinci Code about the Illuminati, and everybody was talking about it. And,
yeah.
And I'm like, it's a book. It's fiction. How many times does Dan Brown have to say that?
Well, that's true. And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, absolutely, Illuminati became a huge thing. It still is. The other example that I would cite, which I think is utterly fascinating, is there's this whole theory that I used to think was ridiculous, but I don't think it is, that the movie Braveheart is essentially responsible for the massive upswing in the Scottish secessionist movement. And that
really?
It essentially, I don't, you know, when I was really young, no one talked about Scotland leaving the United Kingdom. It was like, it was the fringe of fringe ideas. And there's a lot of historians here who would say you can date that rhetoric, the mainstreaming of that rhetoric, to Braveheart, because it was a colossus of a hit. It was just an absolute juggernaut, and it embedded an idea grossly, I mean, you know, obviously should point out it's set in the reign of Edward I in the 13th century, but its rhetoric embedded an idea grossly misleading that Scotland was conquered by England, and it sort of led to, you know, this later, when talking about the British Empire, it has led to this idea somehow that it was the English Empire, and that none of the other four nations had anything to do with it, and that really England called all the shots, fired all the shots, and that England was the sole oppressive partner within the four. That is simply not true. Scottish involvement in building the British Empire was as significant as English involvement in it. But a lot of people think the romanticisation and the mainstreaming of Scottish separatism and Scottish nationalism can be dated to Braveheart. I would tend to say that's probably a bit simplistic, but there is no denying that in the same way as you're talking about the Da Vinci Code with regards to the mainstreaming of the Illuminatius idea, there is an element to which when a book or movie is that popular, and in the case of Braveheart, I would say that's beautiful to look at with that incredible music and acting, that it lets into the mainstream with very little historical context and a lot of emotional heft, an idea that becomes very difficult to dislodge.
That's fascinating. I just think it's really, I love movies. I'm a big movie person. And I can see how movies get under people's skin in different ways.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating that it can start an entire, it's a fictional movie. And it's based on history, but it's fictional. And it's just, to me, fascinating.
Well, Sherry, because I think what you're, just as you're saying that, it sort of gave me the idea. Sorry, I think I kind of interrupted you there, which is very rude of me. I was just sort of carried away by your point. I was like, this is a good one. I really like it. I think the thing that, actually, you could even push that point and try to say to people, both people who are really obsessive about historical accuracy, and of course there are discussions to be had when some of them are like wildly misleading, or in the case of some big shows, insulting or mischaracterizing the still living or the recently dead, that's a very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I sometimes think when people are like, you know, complaining that something doesn't look right or something, they don't like this casting, some part of me thinks, good, I want you to visibly, quickly, easily remember that this is fiction. Enjoy it, love it. I love historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just assume all of it, until you're told otherwise, assume all of it's fake. Just assume all of it is untrue. And then when you read a non-fiction book, assume the opposite. I think a lot of people go into this assuming that historical fiction needs to be more true than fiction. More truth than less fiction. That is not its title. The most important word in it is not historical. The most important word is fiction. Enjoy it for what it is. It's, you know, don't expect, think of it as a milkshake. Don't think of it as a medicine.
Well,
and you won't be disappointed.
The point is about historical movies or historical television dramas is that it's supposed to be fictional that inspires you to read the facts, to get a book, to really look into it.
Or...
Go ahead.
Well, it can be. Absolutely, I would agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. No, sorry, I agree with one part of that. The bit I would disagree with, if I'm totally honest, is... You're not under any obligation to go and do the research afterwards.
Oh, no.
If you just
no.
want to enjoy that book, you know. And so I think
I'm just a nerd. I like to, if I love a movie,
yeah, me too.
And I want to read everything I can. I mean, I watched Wolf Hall, and I wanted to read more about all the people in the Tudors. I mean, you know.
Sure, right.
But that's me.
Yeah, oh, totally. I'm on the nerd bus with you, 100%. But each to their own. You know, this sort of end where we started, to each their own. And I think, you know, one of the things that why I love the format of your podcast is the idea of reducing the structure and elevating the tone to make it a conversation where after we sent a cup of tea or coffee before we started recording.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way to do it, because what we're doing is I hope each of us are getting back to really enjoying what we enjoy and using history to further our understanding of the present and the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really do think history is absolutely invaluable for that, and I think any politician who has not read history or studied history or understands history, I think, is doomed to make some truly massive mistakes, because they'll fall into the trap of thinking what they're doing is original, it's never happened before. There's no such thing as there's nothing new under the sun, as they used to say. And I think history is invaluable from that perspective. But I think from a reader's perspective, you can be a big nerd like you or I, or you can be a casual reader. Enjoy each and every second of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think history is, to me, both a warning and a thrill and a terror and a joy. And I just think take the enjoyment with you as you go in whatever way you want to do that.
Right. Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with just having fun. That's not what my point was.
No, not at all.
My point was just, if you're passionate and you found something stimulating and you want to find out more,
perfect.
Don't go on the internet and read conspiracy stuff. Go and buy a book.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Support your authors. Go to the library if you're, you know, and also, you know, you should point out, you know, authors do get residuals from library loans. So you know, go and check out the library as
mm-hmm.
well. I mean, some authors really, you know, particularly authors who are starting out, or maybe authors who aren't, you know, for whatever reason, health-wise, aren't writing anymore, they'll really appreciate that.
Hey, I finished Duchess of York's second book. It was really good.
Oh, good. I haven't read it.
It's really good. And I didn't know it was about her family until I got to the end of the book.
Yeah, great idea.
It was fascinating to read the end about what was real and what wasn't, and what was part of her family and what was made up. It's really good. So if you haven't gotten it, go get it. And I got mine from the library.
Perfect segue. Well, there's a recommendation, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to give something that's historical fiction, that's current, that's fun. And
yeah,
said,
I love that.
You know,
definitely check
that out. And I figured it was a good way to finish up. Now, I wanted to know, I know about your book about the Queen Mother. Do you have anything new that's coming up that you want to tell people?
Yeah, the Queen Mother's book I wrote about Queen Elizabeth, the Mother, Juliet's Have Another Drink, will be out this fall in paperback. It's out now. But on December 5th, I have a new book coming out in the ES called The Palace, 500 From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of British History at Hampton Court. It's a different room per chapter, different decade, really telling the story of the monarchy and the country through different people.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a great, I love doing it. I'm very pleased with it. I'm very pleased with the idea that we had to work on it. And I absolutely find this such a fascinating book. It's full of, you know, big political questions, but also sexual scandals and the lives of servants as much as royalty. So yeah, I had an absolutely fantastic time researching.
And Hampton Court is really cool because it has that Georgian section and the Tudor section. And
absolutely. Well, that was the joy of it, Sherry. You know, I start with chapter one is set in the kitchens in 1495, and then by chapters 19 and 20 and 21 are set in Georgian drawing rooms, staircases. So yeah, that's part of the real thrill of it.
That's so cool. Do you have any events or anything coming up that you want people to know about?
I think I'll be in the US for book tour in December, but it's TBC.
Okay.
So can find me on my podcast at Single Malt History or Instagram at _Garth Russell.
Okay. And do you have a website, or is it just where the podcast is?
Website's developing, but I would head to the podcast and Instagram for the time being. So we're trying to get something set up this time to coincide with Hampton Court's release.
I just want people to be able to contact you and say hi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, very kind.
Okay. I just want to
Thanks
be sure.
So much. Thanks.
I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to chat with me.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so, so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.